All right. So is it going to rain this afternoon? Are those rain clouds? I'm just asking as I plot the afternoon. So we do say that equanimity is really the hidden, you could say, element of mindfulness. Mindfulness, by definition, doesn't just mean knowing what's going on, that you feel a pain in your knee or a heartache or you hear a sound or you feel joy. Mindfulness, by definition, means that we are with what's going on in a way that's not clinging to that which is pleasant, pushing away that which is unpleasant, or going to sleep when our experience is neutral. So that's the equanimity part. We can fully, with mindfulness, experience the pleasure of something, actually enjoy it quite a bit more, because we're more present for it, but without that extra thing. We do of saying, I've got to keep this, I've got to control it, I've got to keep it from changing, I've got to make sure it's here tomorrow. But rather, we can be much more fully with that pleasant experience through the non-clinging nature of our relationship. We can be with painful experience with a much more open heart, recognizing that so much of our conditioning is to be afraid of pain, to be ashamed of pain, to feel we have to hide it or push it away in others, rather than having that very present compassion toward ourselves with our own painful experience, and ultimately toward others, certainly, as well, building on that foundation. And that's the equanimity part of mindfulness as well, to be able to be with our experience without so much shutting down and resisting and hostility and fear and so on. And as the Buddha taught, not only do we experience some things as pleasant and other things as unpleasant, but there's a whole range in there of neutral experience, very ordinary experience, like just a breath, or just a sound, in which we tend to go to sleep because we often rely on the intensity of the pleasure or the pain just to feel alive. And in that middle place, it's like, it's just a sound, just a breath. We just get numb, or we disconnect, or we go to sleep. And so the Buddha talked about being very present in those circumstances too, where we can actually wake up and not be so dependent on an increasing intensity of stimulation in order to feel alive. So that's mindfulness. Classical way of describing mindfulness is to be aware of what's happening without grasping, aversion, or delusion, which is that going to sleep. So especially as the word gets so popularized, that needs to be recalled, I think. It's not just knowing that there's a sound, but it's being quite aware of how we are relating to that sound and modulating that relationship, because we can. So balance or equanimity is at the core of what we call mindfulness. And there are ways of seeing it that are about perspective. In the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, they use this example, which I've also always liked. They say, think of what it would be like if you were a very, very elderly person sitting in a playground watching children play. That's how you should relate to your thoughts. As though you were quite an elderly person sitting in a playground watching children play. as compared to taking them to heart and identifying so utterly, or resisting and resenting. And I like that example because I think there's a lot in there. There's a lot of tenderness, and yet also spaciousness. It's like if you were quite an elderly person sitting in a playground and you watch this little kid break their shovel and freak out, you wouldn't be cold and disdainful and say, "Hey, kid, it's just a shovel." You know, like, wait till you have a mortgage and, you know, all this other stuff. It wouldn't be that. You'd be so sweet and present and caring. But you know it's just a shovel. Lots of shovels break in life. And there's a kind of bigness of perspective that's really spacious. At the same time, there's all that tenderness and connection and caring. So that's equanimity. It doesn't mean we don't resonate with something, either our own or someone else's situation. We do resonate, but it's in a really different kind of space, and that's why it frees us. So whenever we practice mindfulness, we are really deepening the quality of equanimity if we're actually practicing mindfulness. Because it's got to be about that relatedness. Or it's something of an attention training, but it's not actually mindfulness. And that's why we say, in terms of mindfulness, it can go anywhere. Because what we're paying attention to quote, you know, 30 years of Mark Epstein's practice, what we're paying attention to is not as important as how we are relating to it. So mindfulness is about the relationship. Therefore, you don't have to feel despondent because what's happening is so dreary or unexpected or routine or whatever it is. It's how we are with it that's going to be onward leading. And that is so tremendously freeing and forgiving. For all the time we spend thinking, you know, as I quoted this morning, too bad I live in New York, if I didn't live in a place that was so noisy, I could really meditate, or if only this wasn't happening, if only that wasn't happening. But to have that sense, I can utilize anything that comes my way. Not that we don't have preferences, of course we do. And we also try to set up greater simplicity or clarity or whatever in our life. But ultimately, we're not in control. I was once teaching in New York City, downtown in this area called Tribeca. I was teaching in a Tibetan center, which was a very beautiful room, but you actually can't get into the room from the front entryway of the building. You have to go all the way around behind the building, down this alleyway, up this separate set of stairs that go directly into that suite of rooms. So this was the first night of a six-week series, and I started the way I started here in terms of the instruction, which was, let's sit and listen to sound. And the instant I did that, some guy came into that alleyway and started screaming obscenities, and he'd call out someone's name and this whole long list of obscenities, and someone else's name, this whole long list of obscenities, and of course everyone was laughing hysterically, and I was sitting there thinking, how many people does he know? And finally he stopped and we went on with the sitting, and then I rang the bell at the end and I said, you know, I give that instruction in Barre, Massachusetts, and you hear the sound of a little bird chirping and the wind rustling through the trees. And give that instruction in New York City. You don't know what's going to happen. But really, we never know what's going to happen. Internally or externally. And what an amazing feeling that we have a companion in this quality that can go with us anywhere. Rather than thinking, oh no, it's all ruined. I mean, of course it's hard. It's not to say it's easy, but it's possible. My Tibetan teacher, again, Sakni Rinpoche, he's a very good mimic. And he's very funny when he mimics us, basically. And he says, oh, maybe you're in New York City, you can substitute London if it's apropos. And you're sitting in your living room and you think, it's too noisy, I can't meditate here. So you go to your closet and you empty it out and you create an entire meditation room in your closet. And you sit down and then you hear the sound of the pipes, the water and the plumbing. And you think, oh no, I can't meditate here, it's too noisy. So you go and you buy those kind of ear things they wear in the airport tarmac, you know, and then you're sitting there in your closet afraid of a sound. Or you sit down, you've got your things on, and it's very quiet, and before you sit down, you smoothed out your cushion so that nothing's rubbing, nothing's irritating, and you're burning this beautiful incense and candles, and everything's just so lovely, and then you have a memory. And it's not a good one. You know, ultimately, we can't control the unfolding of events, but we can be very, very different with whatever comes our way. And that's our path to transformation. And again, it doesn't mean we're passive. We do do what we can do. We don't necessarily sit down to meditate with the radio on and, you know, a thousand things going. But we realize our ultimate freedom is that we don't need conditions to be precisely so. Because we have strengths, we have a capacity, we have a resiliency. Say we have the ability to begin again, to be present, to have love, to have compassion, no matter what. And that's the function of the quality of equanimity. So equanimity also figures largely in the teaching, not only as the ingredient to mindfulness, but as part of this package of qualities known as the four Brahma Viharas. Brahma meaning celestial or supreme, or one translation I heard of it that I liked a lot was the word best. Vihara meaning dwelling or abiding or home. So taken together, these four qualities are said to form our best home. So the first of these is loving kindness, the second is compassion, the third is this quality of sympathetic joy, which I'll describe in a minute, and the fourth is equanimity itself. So in this case, equanimity means the balance that's born of wisdom. It's like that elderly person in the playground has lived a life, seen a lot, been through a lot, watched change, understood change. That's wisdom. Or the kinds of things we discern through our introspection, through our reflection, that's wisdom. And the wisdom of equanimity is what empowers it. Because in cultivating, say, those other three qualities of loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy, what we often confront are many assumptions that are somehow distorted perception. And it's through the kind of vastness of wisdom and equanimity that we can counter them. We can challenge those distortions. So let's just take sympathetic joy as an example. The quality of sympathetic joy means having happiness for the happiness of others. Rather than hearing about or witnessing someone's success or good fortune and falling sway to the voice which says, "Ew, I would be happier if you had a little bit less going for you right now." You don't have to lose everything, but if the light could just dim a bit, I'd feel better. So where does that envy or jealousy come from? And it's very interesting to look at it, to pay attention to it. Because often there are many assumptions. There are assumptions about permanence. You have everything and you will forever. I have nothing and I will forever. Or somehow happiness is a limited commodity in this world, and the more someone else has, the less there's going to be for me. Or, it's a funny one to describe, it's something like that success, that good fortune, that prize was heading right toward me. And somehow you popped up and grabbed it. And if only you hadn't done that, it definitely, inevitably would have come to me. Whereas really, you know, unless we're in direct competition, you know, we've applied for the same job, or we've applied for the same grant, the happiness or the good fortune you have is actually not taking anything away from me, but we feel as though it were taking something away from us. It's a very funny kind of feeling or an assumption that we make. And yet it's really a distortion. I often tell the story, I probably told it here last year, when about once teaching I teach a 7-day loving kindness intensive retreat each year at the Insight Meditation Society, and I was once teaching it, and I used this example to try to describe sympathetic joy. I said, it's like you're in New York City and you open up the New York Times on Sunday to look at the book review section, and you turn to the bestseller page and you notice that your friend's book has gotten on the New York Times bestseller list and yours hasn't. And you think, ugh, should have been mine. And it would have been mine somehow, except somehow mistakenly they chose yours. And if only they had not chosen yours, mine would be there. It's like this very weird, distorted way of thinking. So I use this example in the retreat. By the greatest of ironies, I happen to have, coincidentally, three different friends in the group, each of whom had books on the New York Times bestseller list. And they each came up to me afterwards and said, is that how you felt? And it just came out of my mouth. I don't know why. But now I have to think if I should write at all anymore. You know, but what a weird feeling. Like, and yet we get lost in it, and it's very consequential. So equanimity reminds us that nothing's been taken away from us. Nothing is permanent. It's not that you have everything and you will forever, and I have nothing. First of all, that part's not true either, but certainly not so forever. It's the wisdom element of the equanimity that asks us to look accurately and truthfully at how things are, and it just opens up our world in that way. So there are ways with each of those qualities, loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy, that equanimity figures in. And, you know, we'll talk later about certainly compassion and that work. And even with loving kindness, which is considered almost like the foundational practice of these four, it needs to have equanimity. Loving kindness is a perspective and a practice that, first of all, honors our connection. It recognizes how connected we all are. It doesn't mean we like everybody. It doesn't mean we approve of everyone's actions. But the bottom line is that we are connected. That's just the nature of the world. And so whatever action we may take, whatever response we may have to a situation can be informed by the realization that the construct we make of self and other and us and them is a construct. That in truth we live in an interconnected universe. So, for example, I'd like to do this reflection, which we can do together right now for a few moments, of if each of us could just think and bring to mind those people who are somehow involved in the fact that we're sitting here together right now. Like, how many people gave us a book or read us a poem or told us about their meditation practice. You know, nobody presumably was driving by and on a sudden impulse made a turn into the driveway. I'll go there. You know, each of us has been brought here by all of these interactions and relationships and encounters. So many. I went to India for the first time as a university student. So sometimes when I do this, I had an independent study project that they accepted to send me to India for theoretically for a year. It lasted a little longer. But sometimes when I do this reflection, I think of the university, the administration, the chancellor, board of regents who gave me scholarship, American Studies Department who had this program. Because they're all a part of my being here now too. And sometimes when I do this reflection, I also make a point to include those people whose actions have really hurt me. Not just the ones I find kind of irritating or displeasing, but the times, the ones involved in the times where I really felt I've got to find a new meaning of happiness, or I've got to get through this or I will not be free. Because they're part of my being here right now too. And how many forms of life have something to do with the food we just ate, even if it wasn't a distinct animal product? How many creatures live in the soil where that seed was planted? And who planted the seed? Who harvested that crop? Who transported it? Who sold it to us or prepared it and sold it to us? The Vietnamese teacher Thich Nhat Hanh has this exercise where he does something like, he holds up a string bean or something like that and says, now see the world. Because we can see the world in that string bean. That's the nature of life. It's the nature of reality. And one of the things I'm so interested in our time is that it doesn't really take a necessarily spiritual understanding to come to that. Environmental consciousness shows us that, and epidemiology shows us that, and economics shows us that. That what happens over there doesn't nicely and tidily stay over there. Because we're all connected. And everything has implications and ramifications for that. So that's wisdom. And the wisdom yields a quality of recognition, of connection. That's loving kindness. So rather than seeing loving kindness as a particular emotion or sentiment, I really do see it as that deep knowing of connection. So that the construct that creates an other out there is really challenged. And we have a very different kind of worldview that ensues. So loving kindness literally is the common translation of the word metta in Pali, M-E-T-T-A. If more exactly, it is translated as friendship. Loving kindness is a good translation of it. But my concern is usually that the word loving kindness itself is a little bit unusual, so we may not, it may start to seem that the quality itself is a little arcane and removed from day-to-day life and precious in the negative sense of the word. Whereas really, it is an everyday reality. It's a moment of complete presence, of acknowledgement, of connection, of caring in response to that acknowledgement. It's almost like a sense of kinship with all of life, all beings everywhere. And there is a way in which inevitably, the more we see accurately, which is based on being more and more mindful, the more loving kindness there will be, because we're just seeing. That's like the nature of things. And it's also certainly the case that one can set out to specifically cultivate the conditions that make for that quality to be stronger, to be enhanced, to be nourished, to be able to manifest. And that's the loving kindness meditation. So that's what we're going to do for the next little while. It's its own technique of meditation. And it's a very interesting experiment. Sometimes people don't like it. You know, they have a certain concern that, I would say they don't like it in thinking about it, not necessarily doing it. You know, they have a concern that somehow doing that kind of practice will be phony or pretentious or coercive in some way, that they'll try to force themselves to feel something they don't actually feel. And I really see it as an adventure in attention. It's being willing to consciously take some risks with our attention. So that if we normally see ourselves or see others in a particular way, we're willing to experiment. Well, what happens if I do this instead? What happens if I do that instead? Like, let's say you're the kind of person who tends to, at the end of the day, evaluate yourself as though to say, how'd I do today? And let's just say you're the kind of person who might tend to pretty much only remember the mistake you made, the thing you didn't say so well, the really stupid thing you said at lunch. Let's just say. So much so, as I said earlier, your whole sense of who you are and all that you will ever be just collapses around that really stupid thing you said at lunch. So the play of loving kindness is almost like one of asking yourself, anything else happened today? Like maybe anything good? Anything good within me? So you're just playing with your attention. I've done, as far as I know, only one like completely American thing here in London, where my friend took me to lunch somewhere, and we were, it was kind of like a buffet, except people were serving you. And when I went back for coffee and dessert, she was sitting at the table, and I went, you know, back to the serving tables, and I said to the person behind the dessert counter, I said, I would just like the custard. And they said, just the custard? And I said, yeah. Just the custard, which in America is like a standalone dessert, is custard. And they said, just the custard. And I said, yeah. So I took the custard, and then I went to pay. And she said, just the custard? And I said, yeah. And she said, no charge. So then I sat down with my friend, and I got it, and I said, oh, that's like the sauce or something, right? It was like saying, I just want the gravy, not hot roast. She said, yeah. And I will say it was a lot more watery than American butter. But it was just this moment of like, oh, I just did something really silly. But do I then say, that's who I am? This is who I will always be. Or can I hold it in a more amused light in some way? So the effort in loving kindness practice is to direct attention in all these different ways. It's kind of creative and interesting. The effort is not to make up some feeling that you don't actually have, but to see what happens when you look for the good in yourself, for example, rather than just fixate on what you've done wrong. When we pay attention to someone we normally look right through or ignore, who is the other, not even through antipathy or dislike, but just indifference. Checkout person at the supermarket, or that woman who wouldn't charge me for the custard, who suddenly came alive for me in that moment. You know, what about all those people we look through? What about creatures that we don't recognize as forms of life? What happens when we pay attention to them rather than ignore them? So all of that is in like the play of loving kindness. And equanimity is central to that. Otherwise, as we practice loving kindness, as we're about to do, it's practiced through the silent repetition of certain phrases, usually very simple phrases, which are just the conduit for our attention. That's how we're using it. So simple phrases like, may I be happy, or may you be happy. May I be peaceful, may you be peaceful, something like that. And it's very easy for metta to become what one friend of mine once called it, metta with an edge, loving kindness with an edge. It's like, may you be happy by Sunday night, because I've got a lot to do next week, and you know, I figured out exactly how you should act so that you are happy finally, so get with it. It's quite an edge, and it's very easy to fall into. So in order to be free from that kind of expectation, demand, we need equanimity. We need that spaciousness. Another way of saying it is that those first three practices, those first three qualities of loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy are considered practices of generosity. It may not be material generosity, but it's like generosity of the spirit, to pay attention to someone, to include them rather than exclude them, to care rather than ignore. It's like generosity of the spirit. And like any practice of generosity, there are different motivations, different layers, different ways to practice. There's a big difference between a freely given gift and a gift that's given with a lot of demand or expectation. Like, thank me already, would you? Or, you know, what do you mean you haven't read the book? It's been a week. Something like that. There's a big difference. And it's equanimity that allows these practices to be freely given without needing so much according to our timetable, according to our agenda, and so on. So we'll explore through today and tomorrow the nature of those interactions. So loving kindness practice is done both sitting and walking. And I want to start with walking. And again, if physically walking is an issue, you don't need to walk in doing it, just get outside. And you can do the whole thing in the same way. So again, just some minor principles, like eyes open. And I will say, silent repetition of phrases again. I was once in Berkeley, California, which I'm sure you know has a reputation for being very hip and on the edge, kind of. And either I was not clear enough in giving the instruction or someone misunderstood, because I was at a yoga center and we did our walking. We had to do the walking on the streets of Berkeley, so when this woman came back in, she said, well, I saw this group of people on the corner and I mustered up all my courage and I went up to them and I said, may you be happy. And I thought, well, at least it's Berkeley, you know. I'll probably be okay. I wouldn't try that in New York, actually. Or London. So in this practice, rather than gathering our attention around the sensations of the movement in walking, we have a light awareness on the silent repetition of certain phrases. And again, there are many styles and many ways of doing it. I'm going to tell you my favorite and suggest you do it that way. And that is, you can walk at a normal speed, slow down if you feel like it, but you don't need to. And what I like to do is, as a baseline for that light attention, be directing the phrases toward myself. So I'm basically repeating as I walk along something like, may I be happy, may I be peaceful. In sitting, we tend to use three or four phrases. In walking, you may want to have fewer phrases. And the phrases, as I'll describe much more when we do the sitting, need to be very general. Things like, may I be happy, may I be peaceful. So you're just walking along. Sometimes people like to say the phrases in conjunction with the step, or you can just be centering your attention on the phrase. So there you are, walking along, may I be happy, may I be peaceful. And if someone comes strongly into your consciousness, you hear a bird, you hear a dog, you see a person come by, just for a moment include them, like, oh, be happy. And then continue on with the phrases for yourself. Now, there's a lot of life out there, and it would be easy to go, like, be happy, be happy, be happy, be happy. Which is why I suggest having that centering point be the phrases for yourself. And again, just see what happens as you do this. And the absolute essence of the practice is going to be the ability to begin again. Because your attention will go everywhere. See if you can bring it back. Okay, so do you have any questions just about that technique before we do it? Yeah.
So in the walking for this exercise, it's not necessarily walking from there to there and back again.
Yeah. The question was, in this walking style, in this particular exercise, is it necessary to walk back and forth and just back and forth? It's really up to you. It's not necessary, but I don't know what the logistics, or I don't know what the practicalities are out there on these grounds and so on. So it's fine to walk back and forth, or it's fine to extend the walking somewhat if that's possible. And ultimately, this is really my favorite way of walking down the street, is silently doing this practice. And so I think it's a great experiment. It's a great thing to get used to. You can slow down if that seems best, but you don't need to. Also, you know, as you're doing it. So I'm just trying to figure out the time given the three different clocks. Okay, why don't we see if we can be back here by quarter after by that clock. So if anybody has a different time than that, which is probably everybody, you can make the adjustment. Again, we'll have a bell rung before then. Okay?